Draft night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast had some big trades that happened early on in the process, some big surprises as well early on in the process, some guys who dropped in really interesting fashion. And Danny, I think the place we got to start, though, is Serge Ibaka no longer a member of the Oklahoma City Thunder.
In complete honesty, I'm still in shock because while you and I have discussed the idea of, you know, Serge Ibaka's kind of waning value in that sense and that he's going to be a free agent. First of all, I didn't see him getting traded now. And second of all, the nature of the trade is shocking from basically all angles.
Well, start a little bit with what some of the motivations for this were. Ibaka was getting a little bit unhappy. Ken Berger wrote a piece on it that was sourced saying, and Serge also had some comments, which I actually echo, that he was underutilized offensively, that he just would never get a touch. I didn't like the way that they ran their offense, especially late in games. I felt like he was capable of doing more, and he basically was just asked to spot up at the three-point line, and that was basically it this year. So they moved out. They thought maybe he was going to leave after 2017, regardless of whether KD stayed or not, that if he did stay, he was going to be extremely expensive, although now they're going to have to pay Oladipo, but they also may not have to pay Waiters now. That's, you know, Waiters may be superfluous because he and Oladipo are pretty similar. So with that being the case, the trade was Ibaka for Ersan Ilyasova, Victor Oladipo, and number 11 pick Domantas Sabonis. Did the Thunder get better next year by making this trade?
Not if their goal was to win the NBA championship, it didn't.
Why is that?
Because they're a lot easier to defend now, in my opinion. While Victor Oladipo is a wonderful player, they're now starting a backcourt that are both below average three-point shooters. They're both good players, but that's not what they're good at. And the lineup that they ran that was so good against the Warriors, as Steven Adams...
The Megadeth lineup that you so brilliantly coined.
Which is now Mega Dead, is it's extremely disappointing. Like, so the craziest thing about the OKC series to me was that Steven Adams was the third best player on the Thunder, but the best lineup for the most part that they put out there did not have Steven Adams in it. And the reason for that is that Ibaka is so much more versatile defensively, even as he is, let's say, post-prime physically, that it worked in a different way, and he has better floor spacing and all of that. And that dynamic is incredibly hard to replace and is not replaced in the guys that they brought in. And while Oladipo is probably a better player,
I think Serge Ibaka is a better player than
Oladipo. Oh, no, I agree with that, too. No, well, I was going to say, while Oladipo might be a better player than the guys he's replacing at the two. Oh, no, he's not a better player than Ibaka. But I don't think he's better by enough to justify that swap. So I understand the pressures that led to the trade, and obviously to me it's not as egregious as when they did it with Harden, because Ibaka is not as good as Harden was and is not about to be a restricted free agent. He's going to be unrestricted and would have probably left. But to sacrifice, in my opinion, in the short term, when your team is a title contender, arguably a title favorite, is shocking.
So, obviously, my initial impression on this, before I read any reporting or anything, was this reminded me of trading Nick Batum before LaMarcus Aldridge left last year. Now, there have been a lot of pushback on that. Maybe that's not true, probably isn't. But that's what I thought of, is, all right, they're trying to get younger, get guys with more potential while they can. And because I agree with you, I don't think this does make them better next year. I mean, I think Oladipo, you could say if he's going to start at the two, which you'd have to imagine he would, maybe he can get better as a three-point shooter. I mean, he again kind of falls into the same category of guys that Sam Presti has traded for, Waiters, Cantor. And in the Thunder defense, those guys improved from where they were when the Thunder acquired them. And Oladipo could look a lot better shooting open threes, but it's not like he was taking like these incredibly contested threes before. Oladipo has great defensive tools, but also never really produced in that area defensively. He was always kind of overrated for Orlando. Maybe they feel like they can get more out of him, but he also is not quite big enough to really defend other teams' wings at an awesome level. You know, you can defend two guards pretty well, but not necessarily wings. And I think Ibaka was underutilized there. Maybe he was always going to remain underutilized. They had Steven Adams at center already. Maybe they want to just give Roberson the position full-time at the four now instead of the two, which he had been playing, and just play with he and KD at the forward spots, Oladipo, Westbrook, those are your starters. I think that is certainly a worse defensive starting lineup, but it kind of fixes the, I mean, Ibaka almost gives you more spacing than Oladipo, number one, because he's going to be guarded by a big and stretch you out in that way. And number two, he's probably just a better wide open 3-point shooter than Oladipo is. So, and Ibaka is, I think, always going to be a better defensive player than Oladipo since he's a big as well. Ilyasova, Sabonis, I mean, Ilyasova could be an okay backup option off the bench, but in the playoffs, he's going to play 10 minutes a game. You know, he's not athletic enough to really hold up that well defensively. He takes a lot of charges, as Sam Presti just said in his press conference. But yeah, I mean, the more I think about it, I think that this does make them worse next year, and it does give them, you know, another guy maybe who can theoretically playmake. But Oladipo has never really been able to score efficiently in his career. You are taking, again, just like with Waiters, just like with Cantor, a gamble for next year that he's going to fulfill his potential, trading away a known quantity like Ibaka. I mean, maybe if they know for sure that Kevin Durant is about to re-sign and he's going to re-sign for more than 1 year, yeah, I think I'd like to steal more. If you either don't know whether he's going to re-sign it, and I like it more if they know he's leaving as well. But if he's only re-signing for a year, if you think that's the most likely outcome, which is what I do, then I don't particularly like it because I think this makes them worse next year. And they are unlikely to have additional flexibility other than just the full mid-level exception to bring in additional talent.
And that ties in with what bothers me immensely about this trade, which is that, so I made a snarky comment on Twitter about how, like, oh, Kevin Durant, you need to think of a team that has an all-star power forward, joking about the Warriors, especially considering my history with Durant and the Warriors. And I got a few comments, including one from friend of the podcast, Bob Vigueras, about, oh, Oklahoma City doesn't Kevin Durant. That is true. If Kevin Durant was playing power forward, he could be awesome there. The problem is, they have no threes. This team, like, if you're going to do that, this is the same issue with Paul George at the four. You have to have the
same problem the Knicks had with Carmelo last year, too.
You have to have the other requisite personnel. You cannot play Victor Oladipo at the three and nominally have Kevin Durant as the four. They're just going to put their three on Kevin Durant. I mean, they're going to put their three on Kevin Durant anyway. But this whole thing about Durant playing there, it requires adding an individual that they do not have and that in all likelihood they will not have. And Sabonis is a talented guy. He's a guy that I actually really liked, especially when he was a late first round pick. He's a talented dude. He does not fit the special nature of this team. He could be a nice piece for another iteration of the Thunder, but when you are thinking about a team that has stakes this high, it's crazy. And also, there is this really weird dynamic with Victor Oladipo that I liked him. I had him number two in that draft class that he was in 2013. I really liked him. He has not been the player that I hoped he would be. And that isn't foreclosing anything. He's still young enough that he can get better. But I think some are thinking of Oladipo as the prospect he was when he was chosen and not the guy who hasn't gotten as much better as we all hoped.
Oladipo just turned 24, so he'll be 25 when he reaches restricted free agency next year. And you know what? Trading for a guy like Oladipo, who does have some pretty good upside, the number 11 pick, and Ilyasova, who's like a decent rotation guy, for a guy that could be leaving after next year, is going to be 27, relies on athleticism, is probably going to be too expensive to re-sign. If you're just like some 45-win team, it's actually a pretty good trade. Like, in terms of just asset exchange, they won this trade. Like, I understand that. But just in the position they're in, and supposedly, according to Berger, that this is not going to change things for KD, but Anthony Slater says he hasn't given them any indication, yay or nay, whether he's going to return and he's going to take meetings. I don't know. And then Sabonis, I don't really care for them either. You said, like, to me, Ibaka is what made these guys so difficult to deal with in the playoffs. Both the Spurs and the Warriors had so much trouble with their athleticism, his ability to switch out, move his feet. He's not like the most intelligent defender, but just his ability to shoot threes, his ability to protect the rim. All of that is really, I think, what made them a unique challenge for teams, even if they weren't, you know, the most disciplined team defensively in the world. They were just hard. That level of athleticism was hard to deal with. And I don't think they have quite as much of that now, even though they still have some of it with Durant, Robertson, and Oladipo and Adams. But Ibaka, to me, was almost like the most ridiculous of those guys in some respects. And Sabonis is just like, you know, what he's sort of like a higher drafted version of Mitch McGarry, like a left-handed guy with a better jumper than he showed in college, who gets on the glass. But Sabonis is going to be below average on offense. You probably can't play him I mean, he's a center on defense, and he's really, you know, I don't know what he is on defense.
I think he's a four, but maybe a second unit four.
Yeah, but he's going to be too slow to play the four, and then he's kind of a center on offense too. You know, he's just like, he doesn't fit the way the game is going at the highest levels. A team that wants to compete at the highest levels, I don't think that he is a guy that you could see really getting any minutes, even when he's fully formed in that series that they just lost to Golden State.
And we'll talk a little bit about the other side of this. So I have been critical of this trade for Oklahoma City. I hate it so much more for Orlando.
All right, yeah, why is that?
Because and this will be a story that we talk about with other guys. I like Serge Ibaka in the short term, but signing him to his next contract is a risky proposition because he could be falling off the map, and he relies so much on his athleticism. So if you were Orlando, you are certainly not going to be super competitive this year. I mean, if your goal is to be more than like a playoff team. And if you are retaining him, whether that be through a renegotiation and extension, which I think is a very real possibility with him, or just trying to sign him outright, you're not getting a discount, and you're going to be getting him for more albatrossy years than what you're doing with that. So you have that as
yeah, because you're going to have to probably sign him to a 5-year contract starting when he's 28.
Yeah.
Next year, you know, the bird rights will transfer with him. So yeah, that could be pretty ugly.
And they gave up guys that tied in with their timeline. Whether or not you're high on them, at least those players made sense. You know, like Victor Oladipo, like now, and we talked about how I just mentioned how they're not going to be competitive this year. Their guards right now are pretty awful. Like, I mean, Fournier is all right. Alfred Payton.
If they retain him, yeah. Too. I mean, they might have to pay him $20 million a year to retain him.
Yeah, and Alfred Payton, if he gets an offer. Payton's not there yet. Like, this is, so they have a bunch of interesting guys. I mean, I am the Archbishop of the Church of Azonia, but he's not ready to be that guy yet. Like, he's not a starter on a playoff team right now. And Ibaka, while I am intrigued by him at center, that's what he'll have to play with Aaron Gordon, and then he can dance with Nick Vucevic. They can kind of do that three-way thing. But that's not good enough to do a whole heck of a lot. And I just don't understand what Orlando wants. And it is better in some ways than some of the other bad ways they could spend their money. But I think Ibaka will end up being a mistake if they retain him. But I'm also not completely convinced that they do, because if he is looking for being on a relevant team and being, you know, valued and all that kind of
stuff. And there are also no rim protectors available in the 2017 free agent class. He is going to get paid.
He's going to get paid, whether it's by them or by somebody else. And there will be teams that are on the market that year that are desirable. And if Orlando doesn't show a heck of a lot this year, which I don't think they will, you know, they might make the playoffs at the fringes, but they're going to be that, and they don't have a ton of just future assets. Like, they're not overflowing like they used to be. That I wouldn't be surprised at all if he left or if they required overpaying to keep him. And so I dislike the trade for Oklahoma City because of their things, but I despise it for Orlando.
Yeah, this is certainly a win-now move. And, you know, they also would have had to pay Oladipo next year, too. Like, let's not forget that. Now, they at least could have maybe retained him if they wanted to, but they have Hazonia, who they obviously think is the future. They've got Elfrid Payton at the one, who they really like. Scott Skiles didn't like him. That's part of why he's no longer the coach. And they presumably now are going to bring back Fournier, or they can try to fill in some other wings with all this cap space that they have. The other issue, too, is Aaron Gordon now, right? Because they still got Nick Vucevic at center. What I would do is I'd just start Ibaka at center, start Gordon at power forward, and then bring Vucevic off the bench where he won't get killed on defense and he can just score at will against other teams' crappy second unit centers. Like, that's what I would do. And then you would have, you know, Fournier and Hazonia and Payton, and those would be your starters. But, or maybe some other free agent wing that you would sign. But I don't think they're going to do that. I think, especially given Frank Vogel's normal proclivities, he loved to play two bigs in Indiana, chafed at having to not do that. They didn't have the personnel, obviously, either. So I could see him either bring Gordon off the bench, bad, or playing Gordon at the three, also bad. You're not going to have enough spacing, even with Ibaka's shooting. And what would help with Ibaka at the five is then he could provide some spacing for you at the five that you wouldn't really have enough of. I mean, you've still got Payton and you've got Gordon. And if you're going to play those two guys together and you're going to have two bigs, you're just never going to score. And Vogel, for all of his defensive success, was really, one of probably in the bottom half of offensive coaches in the league in terms of their creativity and the way that they played together in Indiana, and obviously the offensive results.
And I would have loved to have seen Orlando get a young project center with something, and instead they have Serge Ibaka, who's already...
Yeah, and couldn't Orlando just get, like, Mitch McGarry or something? I mean, who McGarry is really kind of totally out of it now, I think, with Sabonis coming in.
Or Anthony Morrow, who's almost definitely an afterthought now in Oklahoma City. You get Anthony Morrow, and at least he's a guy who can play 10 minutes off your bench who's making nothing.
There is one other way that, and it sounds like they are absolutely not going in this direction because Presti already said they're keeping Ilyasova, who is $8 million of his $8.4 million is non-guaranteed. But if they wanted to move on from Waiters, who has a $12 million cap hold, dump Ilyasova, he has a July 1st guarantee date, so you'd have to move really fast, which would make it kind of difficult. And then if you could find a taker for Enes Kanter or, Nick Collison, Kyle Singler, kind of dead salary, but maybe give up an asset to get rid of them. Kanter only really has 2 years left because he's a player option on his last year. You could get to actually max cap space. And KD re-signing, Westbrook, and max cap space. You still have Steven Adams on the team. You'd still have Oladipo. That might be pretty awesome. Who would be available to come there? That's a better question. Maybe Al Horford could be one, but Woj reported today that he sees him going back to Atlanta if they offer that fifth year. And it says for most of the guys who are in that situation to get the fifth year, that's kind of what he sees happening, he said. But it would be pretty awesome if they could get like one more max guy, Parsons or maybe Batum or something. But that with the timing, just the way that Oklahoma City generally operates, that's not something that I could see them doing. But it is something that would be like semi-realistic for them.
And I think that would also probably require Durant making a larger commitment, because if you're Nick Batum, why would you sign with the Thunder on a 4-year contract if Durant's about to leave? Like, you could be in the middle of a wasteland in 1 year. It's not even like you'd be there for a couple of years. Like, it could be really, really quick. And I think that is an interesting possibility, and I'm happy that you noted it, but I think it is unlikely. And so, I mean, it would be exciting and fun if they did it, but I don't see it happening.
Yeah, and for Orlando, this trade, they lose about $4 million in projected space, assuming that they would have just waived Ilyasova. So they are now, including Fournier's cap hold, at about $43 million in space, but they could probably get still to two max slots if they really wanted to. They're supposed to go after Al Horford hard, but this may show that they might kind of be lower in the market, as a lot of these teams with a crap ton of space are going to be. We'll move on to some of the other trades. Thaddeus Young to Brooklyn, that was a big one. The Kings actually won a trade. Amazing. They actually had probably the best trade of the day. But first, news from the world of bots. I'm a rather logical person, and as a result, on occasion, my friends will chide me by calling me NateBot, but I now have a bot friend that is the NBA's bot on Facebook Messenger. It's just a chat bot, a robot that you can talk to. You can basically message it through Messenger, and you can watch highlights of your favorite finals games or players. Message it to see the videos you want. All you have to do is go to nbabot.net. That's nbabot.net to get those awesome finals highlights or highlights of your favorite players during the playoffs. All right, so our next one came down during the day today. Thaddeus Young, 2 years remaining on his contract. Once his trade bonus is paid out, he will be making $14.1 million this year, $14.7 million next year, and then he has a player option for $13.7 million the following year. And in exchange, Indiana sent the number 20 pick to Brooklyn, which they used to draft Caris LeVert out of Michigan. Your thoughts?
I think it's a little bit of a sell low on Thaddeus Young. He has 2 years left on a very team-friendly deal, and he's certainly a good player. But I find the timing of it absolutely fascinating, because we just saw the combination deal, which we talked about yesterday, of Hill for Teague and then the 12 pick. And while they are very different players, Teague is on an expiring contract. He does play a position of more value. And so to see him go for, you know, 8 picks higher is fascinating, and then a couple of the picks we'll talk about later. So I think this is a reasonable but low-end return for Brooklyn, and it's also another small win for the Celtics because the Nets got a lot worse.
Yeah, that and it also just kind of shows that Brooklyn, again, is not going to be trying to compete. Really, the only established player now that they have under contract is Brook Lopez. You have to imagine now that they will be looking to move him at the earliest possible opportunity. And, you know, if they just give up a bunch of bad picks, they don't really care. I think it's interesting, just as an aside, that the 76ers were ridiculed for tanking and, in fact, traded Thad Young away in that supposed tanking effort. And yet Brooklyn is acting the exact same way that the Sixers did, despite not having that draft pick incentive. And that shows to me that it actually is to your incentive when you are kind of down, you know, in the 20s and wins anyway, to trade away your established players who aren't on your timeline of ever being good again, get draft picks, get roster spots so you can look at guys, try to develop guys, buy draft picks, all the same things that Philly did, other than the fact that Philly had a draft incentive and Brooklyn doesn't. And that's actually the point that I made when people were going crazy that first year of Philly tanking, that, hey, even when you don't have a draft incentive, baseball teams react the same way, even when before people looked at the baseball draft positioning as really being important. So, I mean, there's a lot of rationality to behaving in a so-called tanking fashion beyond simply, oh yeah, we're going to get the number one pick if we tank.
Yeah, and it's interesting because part of the reason that people killed Philly was because they drafted guys who were hurt. Last year, they took Chris McCullough, who came back really late in the year. LeVert is out. I don't know exactly how long he's out, but he's been dealing with injury stuff for seemingly forever. I do really like his talent, but doing that. And from Indiana's perspective, I'm really intrigued by what they did because they got faster, and they got, you know, arguably smaller because they've got Thad Young, but they're not a good shooting team. Like, Thaddeus Young is, you know, he can make twos, but he doesn't really shoot threes. Jeff Teague, we talked about yesterday, he made the same percentage as George Hill, but that was likely an aberration for him, whereas it's more normal for George Hill. And Monte Ellis doesn't really shoot threes very well. So depending on how they set their alignments, they're definitely going to be faster, they're going to be more versatile, and it could be kind of fun. But they're a different kind of offense than most teams that are a little bit smaller.
I think that's right. And Young is pretty good at switching out on the perimeter. Kevin Pelton had some good stats on how good he performed in that situation this year. So that's useful. And I think he and George could be a nice defensive tandem at the forwards. We'll see whether they re-sign Jan Mahimi or not, or whether it's just going to be full steam ahead now with Miles Turner. If I'm Mahimi, I don't want to go back there. Young is clearly being brought in to play the four. They're going away from you. They have Turner already. I want to go somewhere and start if I'm Mahimi, and I highly doubt that the Pacers are going to pay him his market rate to come back and be a backup either.
And somebody else will pay him his market rate anyway. So unless they're willing to pay you more than that to be the backup, which seems incredibly unlikely.
Yeah, so you have to imagine Mahimi is probably gone. They're going to need some options at backup center. They still have about $15 million in space to work with. I guess they've got LaVoy Allen, who could be an okay backup center still in a pinch. But going back to your initial point, not only can these guys not really shoot that well, but they're just not efficient scorers really anyway. Even Paul George is not that efficient of a scorer. Teague was a little more efficient last year, but that's because he shot probably an unsustainable percentage on threes. Monte Ellis, we know how inefficient he is. Even Miles Turner is shooting mostly mid-rangers at this point in his career. So Larry Bird, well, he's like, oh, we want to get way better on offense. We only get way better on offense. We're going to get small. We're going to play fast. Well, the number one thing you need to get better on offense is guys who can actually score efficiently, and they don't have really anyone on this entire team with a history of being an efficient offensive player.
And they have less money to spend now because they, you know, they switched for Thaddeus Young, and it's very likely to me that they're not going to be deep next year, which is important when you're a little bit older. And I mean, they'll have swingmen, hooray, but they'll probably be a little bit shallow at backup one unless Joe Young really steps up, and they'll probably be shallow at the backup big spots too.
Yeah, now their most likely outcome, including Mahimi's cap hold, they would be at down to $13 million in space now. They get rid of his cap hold, you're up to about $20 million. So they'll have some money to work with still. And they also acquired both Teague and Young, both had trade bonuses. So that didn't help too much in terms of, you know, they could have had a couple million there to play with, but that's just how it works. And they could also bring back Jordan Hill. Solomon Hill, obviously, we know they're not going to be able to bring back.
Wait, really?
So So, I mean, but I think this is just, I don't think this is a bad trade for Indiana. I think that Young is a good player. You got cost certainty for two more years. I think he's probably a little bit below average of a starting power forward for you right now, and it'll probably get a little bit worse over the next couple of years. But one thing that occurred to me with this and then this next trade that we're going to talk about, and then also the one for before, is that with this new crazy cap environment, we've seen a lot of sort of inconsistencies in the values throughout these trades, and even the Ibaka trade too, because I think teams all have now new opinions of how much space is going to be worth. No one really knows how much space is going to be worth. The idea of what's a good contract and what's a bad contract can vary a lot from team to team. So we're seeing more variability. It used to be you could kind of predict, all right, this is what this is worth. You know, if you're going to dump $10 million in salary, that's worth kind of a late first-round pick. That was true for many, many years. Now, though, I mean, I'm not even sure I can say whether George 12 for George Hill with 1 year, $8 million remaining on his contract is a better deal for than 20 for Thad Young with 2 years and $30 million remaining on his contract.
Yeah, it's getting really complicated, and I do really like George Hill, so I'd probably go in that direction. But
yeah, I would too. But yeah, it's different, and I think also because George Hill was basically one of like two players in the league who really fit what Utah ideally wanted at point guard. Good defensive player, good spot shooter, could play either alongside or in place of Dante Exum. It was either him or Drew Holiday. So I think when you consider just that the fit is so good, and that he's only making the $8 million, that's maybe why they kind of paid more than some of these other teams did. But let's get to this perplexing Charlotte trade, if it is in fact exactly what has been reported. That is Marco Bellinelli owed basically $6 million the next 2 years for the number 22 pick.
I have to couch this with if these are the terms. But if these are the terms, last year there were two draft nights trades that knocked me on my ass that were two of the worst draft night trades that I could remember. One was the Hawks giving up a first-round pick that season for Tim Hardaway Jr., who I thought wasn't very good. And, you know, he showed more in Atlanta. The second was the Bucks, for some reason, giving up an eventual first-round pick for Grievous Vasquez, who was a one-year rental. This trade, if it is these terms, is worse than both of those trades.
Yeah, I think you're right. Bellinelli was okay in San Antonio, but when it really got down to it, he'd play 5 minutes a game in the playoffs. He's way older now. He did not shoot the ball well last year. Defensive RPM had him as one of the worst defensive players in the league. He'll be better in Charlotte back in a good defensive ecosystem. He was good. I mean, he wasn't good, but he was passable in both Chicago and San Antonio in that regard. Not so much in Sacramento. But I would view him as, even in the new economy, somewhat of a negative contract. And with that being the case, to give up number 22 to get him, I really just do not understand.
And even if you're trading, let's say they end up moving Spencer Hawes, let's say, in this trade, who I think is probably their most onerous contract that could be a part of this, I would still rather have Spencer Hawes on his deal. He does have a player option for that second year. I would rather have Hawes than Bellinelli. And even if it was a close call, you still don't give up the 22 pick for that.
Yeah, that pick ended up being Malachi Richardson, and we're going to go through, obviously, all the draft picks in the first round and kind of talk about them a little bit to the extent that we are familiar with the players. But yeah, I think that there were reports that Charlotte was trying to move Lamb or trying to move Hawes as a way to open up more space to re-sign their own free agents. Maybe that will end up happening in this trade. It will not be legal until after the moratorium is over, so the terms could change a little bit. That's why you were so adamant about, hey, if it's as reported. But right now, we'll just go on what has been reported.
Well, I'm also like that because it's so insane the way it's reported that it feels like there has to be something else.
Yeah. So,
but great for the Kings. Kudos. Yeah, like the Kings made the best trade of the Kings made the best trade of the draft. Kudos.
Well, and maybe until they drafted Malachi Richardson, who I'm not a huge fan
of. I mean the trade is
still
trade
the
is
value.
The
yeah.
I mean to me I separate that out. While it's kind of hard to parse in that way. They do get credit for doing that. And yeah, it would be hilarious if it was Spencer Hawes, because as we'll talk about later, that would be another center for the Kings.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so one interesting note on this for Charlotte, though, is if they were to take Bellinelli in and dump that pick, they would still be just under the $94 million cap, and it'll probably come in a little bit higher than that. They would still be able to hold on to the cap holds of Nick Batum, Marvin Williams, and Courtney Lee. If you're more interested in Charlotte's offseason, go back and listen to our Charlotte offseason preview. There is a pinned tweet that is at the top of my Twitter handle that has all of our offseason previews if you want to go back and listen to those. But basically, they could possibly retain all three of those guys and hold on to Bellinelli as well. I still just don't quite understand. But you have to think it's likely that either Lamb or Hawes could be in this trade. But even then, you have to wonder a little bit about it.
And Bellinelli's 30. Like, it's not like he's it's not like he's going to be getting better. He's distinctly post-prime.
So those were the big trades. We'll get into a few. The rest of them just basically involved second-round picks. So we'll get to those kind of in order. Let's start with Philly. Ben Simmons, we talked about him already, did a whole, talked about him with Mike Schmitz on the show earlier this week, did a scouting report on him. Not really much else to say about him already that we haven't said. If you want to know our opinion on him, we talked about him for 20 minutes on an earlier show. Same thing with Brandon Ingram as well. We knew that those were coming for a long time. It got really interesting, though, when we got to Jaylen Brown with Boston. He actually was the number two player on my personal board. I'm glad that Boston is listening to the Dunked On Basketball podcast. He would have been my pick here. He would have been just about nobody else's pick here.
That includes me. And I like Jaylen Brown. You know, like he's not somebody who I hate by any stretch of the imagination. I just think that it's also going to be a challenge, depending on what they see with Marcus Smart, to have two guys that are, let's just say, shaky shooters at this point in their career. But the other part of this, and it's really hard to discuss, and this will come majorly into play with the fifth pick as well, is the possibility of the reporting of what trades could be out there, because it's hard to avoid being tainted by that, because like the rumor that was out there about what the Sixers were offering to get either this pick, basically any pick they could get them, Chris Dunn. Like, to me, that offer was insane, but we also don't know if that offer is true.
Yeah, we don't, and there was that same thing out there, supposedly, too, for what the offer was for Justice Winslow last year. Don't know how true that is, but Boston fans, if you want to know why I'm really high on Jaylen Brown, go back and listen to our podcast on June 15th. It did a whole scouting breakdown of why I like him. Basically, in summary, I think he's great with the ball in his hands for his size, fantastic athleticism, and just a lot of wiggle that you just don't see from guys that size off the dribble, and should have some very good defensive potential if it was not something that was realized yet in college. So, and I think he probably, I would say, he has a lower median outcome than Brandon Ingram, but I think he has a higher upside than Ingram does as well, just because I think he could be a really dominating scorer potentially.
Yeah, and we're not going to relitigate that. So let's move on to Phoenix, who took the guy who I would have had third on my board, Dragan Bender, the youngest guy in this draft. He was born in November of 1997, which makes me feel heinously old. And I really like that pick because while the Suns have a lot of uncertainty seemingly everywhere, I think you can kind of slot Bender in eventually, probably not immediately, at the four. And he's a good player. I think he'll do a nice job on both ends of the floor for them there. And if they end up going a little bit switch heavy, which they certainly could, depending on how their talent works out, he fits well with that too.
So I probably would have liked Jamal Murray here if they didn't already have Devin Booker on the team.
Sure.
So I had Murray probably as my number three guy, and then kind of probably Ingram four and Bender five for me. But I like Bender a lot. I think that the statistical translations on him are very strong. Now, it's interesting because they, of course, also drafted another power forward, Marquese Chriss. You could say both of these guys will be at the point, presumably, that they can shoot the ball. Maybe you could say Bender in time with his 9-3 standing reach could play as a small ball center, but he is not really a guy who's going to mix it up inside, certainly on offense. I mean, you could have a lot of shooting on the floor with he and Chris, but you know, the nature of the draft is probably only one of those two guys ends up working out anyway, and we'll get to the trade for Chris, but I thought that was pretty good value.
Yeah, and they'll have enough playing time for both of them right now. Like, you're not going to play Dragan Bender and Chris 30 minutes a game each, so if you want to play them each 20-something, you're fine.
Yeah, and it may not even be that much, but they did just move their D-League team to Arizona, so at least makes things a little bit better there. And so I think Bender, you know, if I were in Phoenix's position, probably would have been the pick for me as well. A guy who's really projects as having a high ceiling on defense, can shoot the ball. They haven't really had that enough shooting at the four since Channing Frye left. So I think that is a solid pick there, and a guy just because of his statistical translation has a pretty good upside. Now we get to Minnesota. Tons and tons of intrigue about this pick. They ended up taking Chris Dunn, who various reporting was they're trying to trade him for Jimmy Butler, who also supposedly Boston was in the mix for him with the third pick. Or Woj said Tom Thibodeau loves Chris Dunn and he was going to be the pick all along, and they're going to stick with him. If it were me, I would have selected Jamal Murray here over Dunn. I think Murray fits really well with what they already have. I think Ricky Rubio is a totally good starting point guard, especially for where this team is at this point in time. And that shooting of Murray could have been amazing. I think that Murray has his offensive upside to me is really high, and I probably would have gone with him over Dunn. But that's just my personal opinion. Most people seem to think that, and Murray was a better fit too, but most people seem to think that this is good for Minnesota. I'm just a little bit worried that Dunn is already 22 and has some issues shooting the ball, and to me doesn't have like the most amazing feel in the world.
So there are two things I want to say about this. One is, Chris Dunn's kind of ceiling is he's a major defensive difference maker who can eventually become a positive offensive player. You know who's already a defensive difference maker and a way better passer than Chris Dunn will probably ever be? Ricky Rubio is. And Ricky Rubio is on a team-friendly contract for another 3 years. And he could be a player, and this isn't necessarily true with Tibbs because he just got there, who his flaws are so well known that people get a little bit turned off by it and forget about all the good stuff he does. And I think that Rubio will be well-suited for that. But then I don't like talking about rumors too much, but I will just make this note. If the sticking point in a theoretical Jimmy Butler deal was the inclusion of Zach LaVine, that is insanity. Zach LaVine is a very good player. I've been high on him for a while, but Jimmy Butler is on an incredibly team-friendly contract and will be and just totally changes their present and their future. And so if it's his possibility, that's to me, that's insane.
The more I think about it, I think that this was kind of BS. I don't know who was messing with who, either Tibbs or the idea that he would be like in talks with the Bulls and Gar Foreman seems pretty hilarious to me, given what their relationship was. And this is a relationship business, even among GMs who, you know, are supposed to kind of be dispassionate. I think that if that was actually a trade, I agree with you, Dunn and Zach LaVine for Butler. If I were Minnesota, I would have done that in a heartbeat. The odds that either of those guys ever gets anywhere close to being as good as Jimmy Butler, a top 20 player in the league, who, as you mentioned, is on a team-friendly contract, are very low, and their defense could be unbelievable if they got Butler. But nonetheless, and Butler is a little bit of a tough fit with Wiggins offensively, so there is that to say. But you could always trade Butler again for someone who would really help you, or you could trade Wiggins too if you felt like you were actually getting really close. But anyway, that's I don't think that was ever really that close, just personally. Or if they were discussing it, one side or the other never really had an intention of going through for it. But now that David Kahn has drafted Chris Dunn to play with Ricky Rubio and insisted that they can play. Oh, wait, no, it's David Kahn. I'm sorry, it's not 2009 anymore.
That's just mean.
But they've been saying, Leighton and Tibbs are like, oh, yeah, they can play together. That's false. They cannot play together.
Neither
of them are good enough shooters. And then you're going to have Wiggins on the floor, too, or LaVine. No, Rubio may be done, but probably Rubio are going to be traded. We'll have plenty of time to discuss a potential destination for Rubio. And maybe they'll keep Rubio around until this trade deadline because Dunn won't be ready and they want to see where he's at this point, or maybe they could move Dunn or whatever. But let's get to New Orleans now. Buddy Hield, again, much would have preferred Jamal Murray, and I think this one is probably going to come back and bite New Orleans more even necessarily than the Chris Dunn pick would. Now, I've been wrong in the past. I was wrong about Porzingis last year that I said they should have taken Moutier instead, and maybe that'll turn out to be right, but Porzingis is certainly looking way better so far. So I am by no means gospel on these things, but you're listening to this for my opinion, and that is what it is at this point.
And I agree with you on it. I think Murray has more versatility offensively. I think they're both good shooters, and I always worry, and this is something Kevin Pelton puts into his models, about a guy who improves a lot late. You know, that it's always a concern. And
that is the history, is that guys who improve a lot late that is actually a negative indicator.
Yeah, because it makes it unrealistic that they're gonna continue it, and he's older.
Or it could have just been a fluke. Yeah. I mean, especially Buddy shooting 46% on threes in the type of attempts. Maybe he just is that guy. Maybe he's just improved to that level. But, I don't think so. And I think Murray is just so much more dynamic with the ball in his hands, so much better passer, can go both ways. He also has a more versatile jump shot as well. You know, Buddy kind of shoots a set shot, but he can't shoot off the dribble going to his right. He can't really come off of screens and, like, plant and rise up either. So he's just the versatility of his shot is much lower to me. And I think, Murray would have been better.
And also,
Buddy will be a little better.
And
on
also,
D,
Murray's more versatile offensive game would have been nice considering the uncertainty that New Orleans has in terms of the rest of their backcourt. Jrue Holiday and Tyreke Evans are going to be free agents after this year. So you need to get something very specific next to Buddy Hield. And Jamal Murray would have given them a little bit more they can do with that. I mean, we still don't know exactly where they're going to go. And Jrue Holiday, to me, is somebody who can play on and off the ball, so you could use that a little bit better with Jamal Murray as well.
So for New Orleans, too, this is another kind of short-term win-now move, even when they're drafting with the number six pick. I mean, because to me, what is your goal? The only goal I have right now, if I'm the New Orleans Pelicans and I really want to try and win at a high level, I got to find another star to play with Anthony Davis. And I think pretty much anyone, even Hield's staunchest defenders, would say that Jamal Murray has a higher upside than Buddy Hield does. So with that being the case, I think that the other thing they really desperately needed is a 3-and-D guy. I would have loved Jaylen Brown for them if he were there. I mean, it's not a three-point shooter, but just someone who can defend his position, do something on the wing. They've just never had any good wings since Davis got there, other than that half season with Pondexter, which coincidentally was the only time they've ever been good. And so I think just you're never going to be drafting this high again if you're New Orleans. You got to go for the upside, even if you strike out. But if you're really trying to win at the highest level, you would have picked Murray here, at least in my opinion.
And along those lines, I thought Denver hit an absolute home run getting Jamal Murray. I really enjoy his fit with Emmanuel Mudiay. They're both guys who eventually will probably be able to defend both guard positions. Murray's not as great at it as Mudiay might be. And the combination of the two of them, if they end up keeping Gary Harris, that's a really fun thing because you can just kind of play any two of them together. And when Harris is out there, he can guard the other team's better guard. I really like all of that. And again, on the idea of star potential, Denver has these guys who I think have some seriously high ceilings in Jokic and Mudiay. And so to get another kind of bite at that apple is notable.
We could see a trade here still. I would actually be working the phones to try to move on from Will Barton, who has a comically cheap contract the next 2 years and scored really well and pretty efficiently, but maybe with a little bit above his head, three-point shooting, with 2 years left on his deal at $3 million per, his value is probably never going to be higher. And he probably, over the next 2 years, doesn't really fit into your long-term plans the way some of these other guys who you have more team control on do. So I would be trying to move Barton if I could as Denver now, because and then they also picked up Malik Beasley, another guy who is kind of more of a 3-and-D guy, but is a pure two, not really big enough to guard threes. So with all those guys at the two, I think Barton could be one that I would try to move if I were Denver. And we can talk at another time about what they might be able to get for him. That would be interesting to think about. Toronto with a boring but I think just effective pick, filling a need with Jakob Poeltl out of Utah, center who has some decent statistical translations, athletic, some questions about his toughness at this point, but he's pretty quick on his feet, might even be able to switch a little bit, should mature into a decent pick and roll defender. And I think they're just looking at him as a backup center for the time being behind Valanciunas, with Biombo likely unable to be re-signed due to cap restrictions.
It's an understandable and justifiable move from their perspective because it is a position of value that is hard to get reliable play for 48 minutes. They were fortunate enough to have Biombo basically fall in their lap when Charlotte declined to extend a qualifying offer to him, and they weren't going to be able to get him back. It is a little bit disappointing just because, I had written a piece for the Sporting News about, it would be so awesome if they could move this pick for something for like Danilo Gallinari. And so you think about the way that could have changed their team and something like that. And we don't know if anything like that was even on the table, but I'm always fascinated when a team that is as good as Toronto is gets a lottery pick. And so in that sense, it's a little bit disappointing, but especially with like Jamal Murray off the board, it's not like those fundamental game changers were really on the board and they missed out.
Yeah, it would have been nice. Really too bad for, because Phoenix obviously took Chris, and we'll get to that in a second after we talk about Toronto. But for Toronto, it would have been nice if they had one more pick. They could have gotten an upside guy, try to get another star with a team that's already kind of complete. So, you know, you had this Knicks pick hanging out there for years and kind of getting a serviceable backup center. It's like, you know, not really that sexy, but I think he'll work out okay for Toronto. And I'm not really sure who else, you know, they should have taken there. Maybe Juan Hernan Gomez would have been a guy who could have matured into being a stretch four to play next to Valanciunas after a while. But let's talk about that trade now. Number 8 from Sacramento to Phoenix, that became Marquese Chriss. And they gave Sacramento number 13, who became Georgios Papagiannis. Was considered not someone who's going to be in that range. Number 28, Scalabissier, also someone not considered to be in that range in the other direction. And then Bogdan Bogdanović, who it was recently reported was not coming over to Phoenix. Maybe he will come over for Sacramento, but you'd have to imagine probably not, because he can get a lot more money once he's not subject to the rookie scale next summer. And then a 2020 second rounder went to the Kings, and Phoenix got number 8. What do you think of that just from a pure value standpoint without talking about the guys who actually were selected? Although Phoenix knew that Chriss would be available, so I guess you kind of do have to talk about it in that respect.
And that's the reason that I like it from Phoenix's perspective, because I thought, while I don't love Chriss as much as some people do, he was really the last guy of that group of like a really intriguing upside guy. And the consequence of giving up a 20s pick and Bogdanović, who looks like is not going to be subject to the rookie scale, to move up those 5 picks, and in that case is justifiable. And for the Kings, I mean, it of course it does depend on how much depth you need. The Kings are a team that could use more guys if you draft well, and we'll talk about whether we think they did or not. And that is an issue for them in that sense. And so yeah, I think from a value proposition, it's a pretty good move for Phoenix and a justifiable move for them. But the way that the picks went down, to me, makes it substantially worse for the Kings.
Yeah, Chriss actually was a Sacramento native. Right. Would not have really been good for them, though, I don't think, because he's a guy who really needs some nurturing. Now, the Suns are probably not really much better in some of their recent iterations, but the Kings in particular, a guy who's kind of a wild, undisciplined player that really needs, but has great talent. Not the type of guy the Kings have typically succeeded in turning into a great player. I think maybe under Coach Yeager, that might change a little bit, but again, not the greatest environment there. But I think just the talent that Chriss had, the upside, I probably would not have necessarily made that trade. But I think at least for Vlade Divac, it seems like he was zoomed in on Papagiannis. I'd recommend watching his Draft Express video. It's actually pretty impressive. And in very limited minutes in the Greek League, he put up some awesome numbers, and he's still super young. He's 7'2". So he could actually end up being really good. Of course, the Kings now have a billion centers. They now have 4 centers on their team. No, I'm sorry, 5 centers on their team. I consider Scal kind of a center, too. Scal, Papagiannis, Kufos, Willie Cauley-Stein, and Cousins. And Cousins was not happy about it. He tweeted something along the line. Do you remember what the quote was?
It was, Lord, give me strength.
That's right, yeah, and a little, like, prayer emoji. So, yeah, it was... I applaud Divac for trading down for a guy that he knew was never going to be in the mix at 8. And who knows whether Papagiannis would have been drafted had he not been taken at 13. And he picked up some other assets too. And Scal, I think, was a great value. Again, though, as a super talented guy without feel, not necessarily who you want going to the Kings. But, you know, it's great value for the Kings there. And Bogdanović, another guy who I think had value for Divac, a Serbian who he's very familiar with from the Serbian national team. And I think Divac has shown that he is kind of more comfortable. He also, Peja Stojaković is one of his main advisors. They're more comfortable with some international guys. So, and also just the fact that they weren't transfixed on this idea of like getting guys that are going to help them this year, I thought was encouraging, at least for the Kings organization. But I still probably would have just made that pick at 8 for Chriss. I think his upside would have been like too much for me to ignore.
And Chriss makes sense in a post-Cousins world as well, just in terms of the idea of him having the physical potential to play next to, to play next to Willie Cauley-Stein or whatever they're going to do with that. So I would have agreed with that. But we'll move on to a player that is exciting for me for a lot of different reasons. And one of them is that you and I are both among the people who have seen him at different times, and that is Thon Maker.
Maker, someone who falls into this Bucks recent category of taking guys who are a little bit less well-known and have some international ties. They really hit with Giannis Antetokounmpo in 2013, where they drafted him higher than really anyone ever thought that he was going to go. Brandon Jennings, also number 10, was drafted higher than anyone thought he was going to go. And, you know, getting him as a starting point guard, starting level player until he blew out his Achilles is actually probably a decent pick at number 10 compared to what that historically is.
And they got Chris Milton out of it eventually.
Yeah, yeah. And now Thon Maker, we still don't know what the story is with the age questions, right? I mean, and everything that you hear, it's so hard to get reliable information because everybody could have a motivation, right? Obviously, his camp has a motivation in making him look as young as possible. And then other teams who want to get a steal on him have as much motivation as possible and kind of leaking that he's older than he actually is. So now you can get him. But you know, he's listed at 19 years old, and I really like what he can do. He is not a banging center. He's not a post-up guy. And when I saw him at the 2014 Eurocamp, he was playing at center, but he got to have the ball in his hands a lot, and his mid-range game was really awesome. Like, he was posting up and like draining jumpers over guys 2 or 3 years older than him from mid-range, and I think even he'll soon be able to pick and pop for three-pointers at 7 foot. He's got a nice wingspan and very quick feet as well. I think he'll be able to switch. I think he'll be good in pick-and-roll defense. Not probably a great defensive rebounder or offensive rebounder, although... And not like a ton of explosiveness. You know, he's kind of more long than he is really super explosive. But he can protect the rim okay. And he also really competes really hard. And he's a great kid. And part of why the Bucks drafted him, he mentioned in his interview that with Yahoo Sports that he was, worked out a bunch extra at the workout with them and stuff. So it was, I think he actually, if he actually is that age, I like the pick for them. If he's not that age, yeah, it's not going to be too good.
So I saw him at Prolific Prep in Napa, California a couple months ago when he was playing for the Basketball Academy in Canada. And I was absolutely transfixed by him for a simple reason. It felt like he wanted to be a guard out there. And some people will see that as a criticism. I don't mean it that way. The guy who he reminded me of, and it's not the same caliber of player or anything like that, but I saw some Lamar Odom in him. And I really liked Lamar Odom as a prospect.
Yeah, he doesn't have any type of the dribbling or the feel, passing feel of Odom. But I understand what you mean.
It's more of a mentality thing than anything else. And that's intriguing because you just don't see many guys. I'm somebody who, it's something that I've noticed with like Anthony Davis, the guys who just have some guard stuff in them that they can they have that kind of ceiling in a little bit of a different way. And Maker, I don't think of him as really a rim protecting center. You talked about that, but he is a nice addition to what I'm starting to call the thicket, which is basically just the series of long armed Bucks. And and he's a good thicket guy. They just in case they need more with basically their entire team, I could rattle off their roster. But I really do like him in that way. And the parallel, while I do not see him as the caliber of upside with Giannis, and I was somebody who beat the drum for you.
Yeah. I actually see him as a role player, personally, but it sounds like you think he has more upside than I do.
I think it's possible. And so basically, what I'm getting at with this is that if part of what I did in, I think it was 2013, that was really unusual, like my draft board, if people go back and look at it, it was basically different from everybody else, was that in a draft that I don't really like, I often turn more towards upside. And just basically the idea of like most of these guys probably aren't going to be starters. And so if you miss, why not aim high? And I think that Thon marks really that transition in this draft where some of these guys will definitely work out. Some of them definitely will not. And I will never blame a team for getting somebody who's at least intriguing.
Yeah, I like him as a role player. I think if he could be a guy who can play, and I think he can guard power forwards in times too because his feet are that quick. A guy who could be a solid pick and pop guy, shoot the ball, and he could probably post up well enough against a switch, maybe. So the one thing I worry about him is fit long term a little bit is that he probably won't really help their problems on the defensive glass. If he's playing with Giannis and Jabari and him all together, probably wouldn't really work that well. But I think it's a good value play, a guy who has some upside who can fill a role, I think, either on this team or another one. Sabonis at 11, now a Thunder. We talked about him already. Taurean Prince was mocked out to go a little bit later by Hawks GM Bike Mudenholzer, but he went at 12. That's the pick that they got from Utah. I don't know a ton about Prince. I'll be honest, he was low enough that I didn't really watch that much film on him, but he's another kind of 3-and-D type of prospect for Hawks University.
I watched a little bit of him a couple different years, and I'm not super impressed with him. I think that he has some potential just because there you see little flashes.
He's a senior, right?
Yeah, I think he's 22, and he's not as good defensively as you would think for a guy who's as old as he is, and I don't completely trust his jump shot, so I would not have taken him this high for sure. And it's not like it's a disastrous pick in that way, but I think it's weird to see Hawks University get these late enrollees, because you would think that you want guys who are raw and who are young and who can get a lot better. And while Taurean Prince is not, he's far from being written off, he is a little bit older, and that's kind of like what they did with Tim Hardaway. So I guess it's just that they believe in their program.
Yeah, I would have, Hernan Gomez would have been my guy here. I thought he should have been, like the number 9 prospect. He did good stats translation. Ended up going to 15 to Denver, reportedly one pick ahead of Boston, who really wanted him at 16. And Denver.
God, if only Boston had any assets to move up and get the guy they actually wanted.
Yeah, well, so Sacramento, we talked about Papianis already. He has a $500,000 buyout, so I think it's expected that he's going to come over. That's you can pay up to $650,000, so you can draft in there. Chicago, Denzel Valentine, he was supposed to drop due to injury concerns, but they felt okay about that. He has had some cartilage issues in his knee, and Valentine does fill a need in the sense that they needed someone else now after having traded Rose who can actually create and shoot the ball as well alongside Butler. But, he's not a great one-on-one defensive player. They just don't have enough guys who can actually keep the ball in front of them who are going to play on this team. And of course, there is the requisite tweet from Casey Johnson that he was number 2 on their board overall behind Chris Dunn, to which I responded was, did their board include only players 22 and over, which knowing the Bulls actually wouldn't be an enormous surprise.
Yeah, I think that there's also this weird kind of reverse stigma out there that Michigan State guys are all good defensively. And Denzel Valentine, while he's not horrible on that end, he's not good. And so he's more of an offense-only guy. And when you hear this weird stuff about Draymond Green, it's like, no, Draymond Green was the runner-up for Defensive Player of the Year 2 years in a row. Denzel Valentine is not that guy.
Yeah, and the Bulls also have, no athleticism on the team now. Like, other than Butler, they really are just struggling to have anyone who can run or jump on this squad. And Valentine does not really help them in that respect either. So Hernan Gomez, we talked about, I talked about him kind of towards the end of my podcast with Mike Schmitz on Monday, so I won't get into him too much, but he's just a stretch four, great statistical translations, was very good with the Estudiantes in the Spanish league, which is basically the second best league in the world, putting up good numbers for them. Excellent rebounder for his size as well, has to get better defensively, but plays really hard, and is a guy who can play above the rim as well. So I liked him. And then Boston with a guy who was kind of, John Gavone said his agent was talking about him going, in the 30s, Gershon Yabusele, out of France, who's kind of a tank size sort of guy, but soft hands, shoots the ball. But I don't really care for him that much. He is going to be drafted and stashed, which I think appealed to Boston, but I don't really care for him that much because he's just, a big guy who's probably too slow to defend anything but fives, but isn't going to protect the rim because he's too small.
Draft and stash is a lot more valuable when the guy is good than when the guy is when you're overdrafting for it. And I think that's something that will be, that was actually a bigger story in the second round, maybe, with some guys just refusing to get stashed. But I haven't seen a ton of him, but I haven't liked what I've seen. So move on to Memphis, to a guy that I've seen.
Well, so one other thing I wanted to add. For first round picks, I think there is actually more appeal in some respects maybe to being stashed if you are a first rounder, because the rookie scale, probably, we don't know this for sure, but the rookie scale will probably go up a fair amount next year. Now, you still want to start the clock on your free agency as early as possible, so I don't know how much appeal that actually does have, but at least it's more appealing now than it would be in other years, at least you can say. So,
that's a good point.
Yeah, you're going to say Memphis now?
Yeah. So they took Wade Baldwin. I like Baldwin for them. I'm not completely sold on him running an offense, though some of his translation stuff is good. But what I do really like is that I think he fits with them whether or not they keep Mike Conley, because he could be the Mario Chalmers who kind of plays next to him and backs him up, or he can be an eventual piece of their, piece of their puzzle. I don't think he should start as a rookie, but other than that, I think he can do a nice fit. And in this part of the draft, he plays a position of value in the league, and I think he can do it reasonably well. And if you're going to be a switch heavy team, which Memphis, you know, depending on what they do with new coach with David Fizdale, they could end up being, if they get the right personnel eventually, he could work with that.
Yeah, he does have a lot of length. Not super athletic, but can shoot the ball pretty well. Both in the conversations that I've had with people around the league and just other reporting as well, the background kind of personality stuff on him is very poor, which is certainly a concern, although Memphis has had some success with guys like that, usually later in their careers, you know, Tony Allen, Zach Randolph types. But we'll see. Detroit, Henry Ellenson, very long, but very unathletic from a jumping standpoint. Very skilled, though, like, but that kind of strikes me as a little bit more of a novelty, just his ability to kind of grab and go. He's not really, like, fast enough to do that much with that. But, you know, it kind of just looks cool, but is it really getting you buckets? I don't know. He's a shooter, did not shoot that well from outside, but will take them and probably will mature into being, you know, a decent stretch five type of player, stretch four.
Point that my former colleague Jonathan Sharks brought up, which is that there are a lot of similarities between him and Donatas Moniunis, who is the player who was originally going to be the result of this pick. And Ellenson, I don't love him, but at least he wasn't taken in the top 10.
Yeah, I think around this point, a guy with that size and this sort of skill level is reasonable. I think he could be a guy to be a good backup. I struggle to see him ever being good enough defensively to be a high-end starter, but we're talking about the 18th picker. If you get a rotation guy, you're good. He's not going to play at all next year. He's probably going to spend a lot of time in Grand Rapids. Stan Van Gundy will bash his head against the wall trying to, because of his defense and maybe even his shot selection as well. So, but I think he could mature into sort of a backup combo big who could be pretty decent at some point in his career.
Next up, Denver again, taking another guy who's intriguing, Malik Beasley. He is a talented shooter. I'm not completely sold on him defensively, but at 19, a reasonable lottery ticket to make. And again, it affects the Will Barton picture just because you don't need that many guys who play the two.
Yeah, and again, Beasley is someone that I talked about fairly extensively with Mike Schmitz earlier in the week. He said that he really liked him a lot. Now, Caris LeVert, not someone that I had a ton of familiarity with, but a guy who at 6'6 has a really nice handle, can play make some, not super explosive, but kind of more bendy. I think a guy who has some upside is someone who, at a shooting guard size, can have the ball in his hands, run a pick and roll on the other side, shoot the ball as well. I think he'll mature into a solid NBA three-point shooter. And, you know, he has the health concerns, like you said, but Brooklyn doesn't really much care about that early on. And LeVert was considered to go a little bit later, but I think they had their eye on him for a while. And, more power to them for going to get their guy.
And then at 21, Hawks University added another late registrant in DeAndre Bembry. He is...
another guy who was a senior,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and he might have been a junior, but he's older. I think he's 21 now.
Yeah, out of St. Joe's.
Out of St. Joe's. And he's unusual in the sense that he has good playmaking ability for a guy who's his size, but he has massive trouble with his jump shot, and he doesn't really have the defensive upside of to be a real difference maker on that end. So he's more of a rotation guy than a starter. Granted, at 21, that's not a big thing, but it is also weird to continue seeing the Hawks draft in the middle when they just thinned out the one perimeter side, and then, I mean, they have Splitter and Horford at the moment, but they don't really have much developmental unless you see Walter Tavares as being that guy.
Yeah, again, I would have liked for them to go for some higher upside plays here, and these guys are going to kind of protection. If Bazemore leaves, you still, even though they're later on, you don't know how much they're going to help in year one or two, but again, they have an idea that they can make these guys into players. But I would love to see, and they have kind of the same philosophy as the Spurs, who actually kind of deviated from that philosophy a little bit, as we'll see, but that they just kind of have high character guys that they want who are going to work. But then your problem is that sometimes, especially when you're not drafting at the very top of the draft, you might end up with not enough talent on your team. And I would have loved to have seen what they could have done with a Scalabissier, Deontay Davis, DeJounte Murray, that kind of guy.
Uwalu would have been awesome for them.
Who?
Uwalu.
Yeah, maybe that's an, I mean, well, I think, you know, he's still the same kind of player as Bembry, a 3-and-D guy. So maybe they just, for that one, I understand a little more if you just had Bembry ranked higher. But, but he's the guy who obviously plays hard, knows how to cut, smart player, the type of guy that, you know, they would certainly zoom in on and think, all right, we're going to really teach this guy how to shoot it. But yeah, I would have liked to, especially when you have the two first rounders as well, to take two guys who are almost, you know, very similar players in some respects. Prince is a little bit bigger, but and I will apologize to the Hawks. I snarkily tweeted that they continue to load up on guys who are too small to stop LeBron, and Brent Berry rightfully chided me that it's not like there's any other player in this draft that they could have selected that would have been big enough there either. But it is kind of too bad for them that just they still are never going to find that guy. It seems like, and they're just going to get killed by him in the playoffs every year.
A team that doesn't have to worry about getting killed by LeBron James in the playoffs. The Sacramento Kings traded, great trade to get this pick. They took Malachi Richardson from Syracuse. I don't think either of us has any particular love for him.
Yeah, even Bobby Marks was killing him on the Yahoo show, which was awesome, by the way.
Fantastic.
You should listen to that next time instead of the ESPN. Schmitz was on there. Gavoni, Woj was on there. Tom Crean actually did a really good job breaking down prospects. I was surprised how frank he was willing to be on some of these guys, given that he's a college coach and guys who have jobs usually don't want to do that. So, I mean, for Malachi, though, it was he shot under 40% from two, not incredibly athletic, not incredibly good on defense, played in that Syracuse zone. He kind of, you know, seems like in the mold of like a Jordan Crawford, or and not even as good of a dribbler or playmaker as someone like Jamal Crawford is. Just, you know, a guy, a Nick Young would probably be a guy who I would also compare him to, not as athletic even as Young, but a guy who just kind of fakes guys out and shoots contested long twos and can heat up, but overall is just not going to be that efficient. Maybe the Kings will make something out of him, but he seems like sort of the sort of guy who, again, is not really going to be like great in their culture, where they're going to like teach him to be like a much more disciplined player, because I think that's what he kind of needs in terms of like his shot selection.
Then at 23, Boston takes, is it Ante Zizic? Is that the best way to pronounce it?
Yes.
And he's a fascinating guy. The limited amount of film I got to see of him, I actually did really, really like him as a potential true center. And as Nate can attest to, I really do like true centers that I think can protect the rim, and he could get there.
Yeah, I don't know if he is going to be that great of a rim protector. He is sort of an energy big, plays really hard, had some good statistical translations out of the Adriatic League, which has produced guys like Jokic and Nurkic of recent vintage, also of who had pretty good statistical translations. But he doesn't really have any one elite skill other than his rebounding and his hustle. So I think he could be pretty good, and maybe he'll end up getting stashed. We don't know what's going to happen with them. Boston, they already got Yabusele to stash, so maybe they'll bring him over. If I were Boston, I would have tried to go with one of the higher upside guys, again, on the idea that you have, you know, someone like Scal, someone like Deonta Davis, maybe even DeJounte Murray, the type, although I don't like Murray as much. Korkmaz, maybe another guy too, because they need someone who can create, someone who can shoot. Guys who, because of where you are, you know, just getting a guy who's sort of like an energy guy, he's going to come over right away, he's not going to play it all this year, probably not going to play it all next year, and then, you know, all of a sudden he's got 2 years left on his rookie deal, and, you know, he hasn't shown like that incredible upside, so it's kind of the new car driving off the lot syndrome with them. That's why I'd be going with these upside picks. That's like, to me, is the big benefit of having all these picks, is like you roll the dice enough times, it's going to come up with something good eventually. And I don't know if this is like that much of a roll of the dice, even though I think he will end up being, you know, probably an effective backup center in the league given his statistical translations.
So I get to tell a little story with 24. So on Real Jam Radio, about, I think it was about 6 weeks ago, I had Derek Bodner on, who's a, you know, another draft expert who is also very well connected with the Philadelphia 76ers. And so the lottery hadn't happened yet. And so I asked him for his top four, and he, you know, he rattled off the usual suspects. Then he's like, somebody who I would consider but didn't have that high is Timothy Luwawu. And he talked about how much he liked him, and that led me to watching a lot more footage of him, because if somebody like Derek, who knows him well, really, really likes him, and I really liked him too, and to see him fall 224 to Derek's team was really exciting for me.
What do you like about him so much?
He is athletic, and I think he can shoot reasonably well, but what I like is that I think he can do more off the dribble than most guys like that. Like, he's obviously not going to be what Danny Green is defensively, but I like that when you put the ball in his hands, I'm not going to anticipate a turnover every single time. And that is something that separates some of the 3-and-D guys that I like the most from some of the 3-and-D guys that frustrate me. And so I think he can piece that together. He also wants to come over right away. and that I think could be good for the Sixers, just because they're going to have those minutes to sop up, and he can grow as a kind of a personality fit with this team. I think that's something that actually really helped fellow Frenchman Rudy Gobert, of the idea of just growing with these teammates that you're hopefully going to have for a long time. So I do really like him. I'm not sure that it would have taken him like in the lottery, but around then, certainly I think that his ceiling of those types of perimeter players is up there.
Yeah, Luau, my biggest memory of him was at the 2014 EuroCamp. He was playing with the French under-20 team. Didn't really do much, except for one time when he tried to just rise up on the baseline. And in a European setting, guys who are like real NBA athletes will really stand out just because they're so much less athletic over there. Most of the guys at a setting like the EuroCamp. And he rose up, just missed a dunk on the baseline, tried to bang on someone. It's really like the only play he had that stood out. But I was like, oh, we should probably watch this guy just based on that. And all the scouts sitting next to me were kind of like, oh, let's see who this guy is. And then he's grown to be a guy who was drafted in the first round. We'll see. I haven't watched enough of him to have a great opinion on what he could be. But he has grown a lot playing for Megalux, which is basically owned by his agency. And they have a great setup there where they just let these young guys play and develop and then try to get them set to clubs that have a lot more money, like the Philadelphia 76ers. The Clippers, Bryce Johnson, kind of a Rock Divers pick.
Yeah, if only he played against the Celtics in the playoffs like 10 years ago, it would have been even more perfect.
Johnson, last seen standing helplessly in the paint as Chris Jenkins hit a long three-pointer to beat his team in the national championship game when he theoretically was guarding him. I don't know whether that's Roy Williams' fault telling him to stand there or his, but not known as the most cerebral player. He can post up a little bit, but not incredible, and get up for alley-oops. But he kind of plays basically within like a 3-foot cube on either side of himself. Like if he posts up, he's going to take one dribble, turn around, jump as high as he can, and try to just shoot a turnaround. Or, you know, he'll get up for alley-oops, but he doesn't move his feet that well. Kareem even said on the broadcast, which I thought was interesting, that, you know, he thinks he's just doesn't quite have like the core and hip strength to like stay in a stance that well. But he's a very sort of like, he almost plays basketball like a volleyball player kind of. Scal actually suffers from that same affliction a little bit, where you're just not moving that much laterally, and when they get the ball, it's just sort of jump as high as they can and shoot it. But it's not someone that I think anyone has ever really been that high on, and not a guy who really has any kind of upside, not a guy I see playing for them at all this year either.
Then the Sixers, between, you know, in the Clippers sandwich, the Sixers take Furkan Korkmaz, Turkish player, talented shooter, and he is not coming over this year, but is still very talented and could be a nice piece for them, let's say, a year from now.
Yeah, and a lot of these teams, at this point, like, I would have been taking Scal, especially Boston and the Clippers and Atlanta, and probably even Brooklyn, too, because I don't care if Scal spent like the last year just like underground in a cave, not touching a basketball. As good as he played in the practices at the Nike Hoop Summit and in that game, like that guy didn't just disappear. Like, yeah, maybe he just can't do it over the time being. Maybe he lost confidence at UK, but just the athleticism that he has and the shooting ability, like you just got to take a chance on that upside when you're drafting in this range. To me, when you're one of these teams that just is never going to have a chance at a star, and yeah, you know, I know he struggled at Kentucky, like came late to basketball, you know, may not have the experience, all that stuff. Maybe there's only a 10% chance he works out, but he could just be potentially like a really, really good player, and I would have taken a chance on him if I were some of these teams, especially these teams with multiple
players. I still love him. I've been on the Scal train for a long time. He's a ceiling play for me. I think he could become, while it's unlikely, he could be the unicorn of the pick and pop center who can actually protect the rim.
Right.
And even if that's a 5% chance or a 2% chance, getting that guy on a rookie scale contract and then having team control for another theoretically 4 years is worth its weight. I admit that I don't know the second half of the first round as well as I usually do, just because of our NBA obligations. I would have seriously considered taking him in the late lottery.
Yeah, I feel somewhat similarly. For Philly, though, they did get Furkan Korkmaz, who is going to be stashed according to David Pick. I think he is someone who has a really nice offensive game, good shooter, gets his shot off pretty well, got some vision, can get up off of 1 foot for some dunks too. Really skinny though, terrible block and steal rates, and so you wonder whether he can hold up defensively. But he's a guy who I think could be pretty dynamic with the ball in his hands, and has produced especially in FIBA play at the junior levels. Toronto, 27, Pascal Siakam. I know nothing about it, I'm sorry.
I don't either.
He's just reputed to be a guy who plays really hard. Someone tweeted that he was like a Tristan Thompson-like kind of guy out of New Mexico State, but not someone that I have a great deal of familiarity with, unfortunately. We talked about Scal at 28 already. DeJounte Murray at 29. It's so funny because literally whenever the Spurs pick someone, actually last year when they drafted Milutinov, who no one had ever heard of, they didn't say this, but the Spurs will draft someone like, oh, it's such a Spurs pick. They're so far ahead of us all. Well, calm down. Like, Kyle Anderson hasn't been like some world beater. And Murray actually is not a Spurs pick. He is a very raw, very inefficient point guard from Washington who's young. I can't think of another time when San Antonio has taken a one-and-done guy, a domestic guy. You know, they've had success with, obviously, Tony Parker at that age from overseas back in 2001. But Murray does not strike me that way. But I like getting more athleticism, maybe a point guard of the future that they can groom behind Parker over these next couple of years. And a good value player there. Murray has talent, really inefficient. But, Deontay Davis maybe would have been another guy, too, I would have liked to see them go after as a way to infuse some athleticism into their front line that they desperately need, you know, going forward. But remember, all these picks are being made for 3 years from now, especially when you're a good team. Like, none of these players are going to help their teams very likely in the slightest. Every once in a while, you'll get like a Norman Powell type, but pretty unlikely.
Overall. Murray is a nice bet on their coaching staff because he can develop a little bit. His shooting isn't great now. The Spurs have an incredible shooting coach. So if they can get more out of him than they do already, they're not going to need anything from him in the next 2 years. So just put him in he can be the first enrollee in Spurs University from the one guard perspective. I mean, they've had him, of course, out of their spots. And I like it. And along those lines, I'm not completely sold on Damian Jones, but I do understand why the Warriors want to take a center with physical potential.
Yeah, Jones, when he loads up, can get out of the gym, can dunk on you. Not a guy in the immediate comparison, obviously, is Festus Ezeli, also drafted 30th, also out of Vanderbilt, also a guy who came later to the game, a cerebral guy off the court who is not actually that cerebral on the court, and also just, you know, a huge center. But Jones is a little bit different in that he doesn't play nearly as hard as Festus did. Much better jump shot than Festus, can shoot a turnaround in the post over his right shoulder in addition to a jump hook over his left shoulder. Jones is also out with a torn pectoral, which he injured in some team's workout, bench pressing 185 as many times as he could, which just seems like the fact that that really is part of his workout just seems like so dumb that like anyone could get injured having to do something like that. And then the Warriors also, will kind of just go through some highlights of the second round here, also bought a pick for $2.4 million, which is the maximum amount of cash they could pay. They already gave up $1 million for it to offload Gerald Wallace for Jason Thompson, but they drafted Patrick McCaw, who is a favorite of some analytic models relative to where he was drafted. He will play in summer league. He's out of UNLV, a long kind of, you know, Corey Brewer type of wing player.
And to me, the most interesting trade that happened in the second round was the Memphis-Boston trade. And so what happened is Memphis traded the Clippers pick that they got in the Jeff Green-Lance Stevenson trade to Boston for 31 and 35.
That is a 2019 first-rounder, lottery-protected for 2 years, and then becomes a second-rounder. And actually, wouldn't shock me if the Clippers are in the lottery both those years, 2019 and 2020, given some of the, you know, Chris Paul's age and the fact that he and Blake can be free agents in 2017. They could actually be pretty bad both those years.
But I think they'll be a playoff team, at least one of them, but it is certainly a risk. And of course, if something falls apart and they miss the playoffs this year, then that pushes back the obligation anyway, kind of like what is happening with some of the other picks that are out there now.
That was an interesting one. And that was the Deontay Davis, who I thought still, you know, only averaged 7 points a game last year for Michigan State, but I thought is someone who has a lot of physical potential, and I thought he probably should have gone higher. But, you know, a lot of times we'll say that, like we were saying that about Cliff Alexander last year, and, you know, he was undrafted and didn't really, you know, break out in any way for Portland. Not that he's done, he's 20 years old, but other guys that I kind of like, Avika Zubac, who could have been drafted in the first round, but turned down a bunch of stash orders offers. He wanted to come to the Lakers right away. Huge Laker fan, apparently. So he is probably going to be coming over. Zubac is a really long but heavy-legged, slow-footed center, but has a nice touch around the rim. Again, another guy with pretty decent statistical translations out of the Adriatic League. Has also struggled with a few injury concerns. Chick Diallo to the Pelicans. That was another trade, 33 from the Clippers to the Pelicans for 39 and 40. I like Diallo as an energy guy, just who can be a second unit sort of shot blocker and dunker. Doesn't have a ton of feel, but you know, someone who could kind of make a rotation maybe. Who else did you like out of the second round?
Tyler Ulis, Phoenix. Yeah. I don't necessarily love him for Phoenix, but I really do like Tyler Ulis.
But there has been a bunch of talk that they're going to trade some of their point guards, so then he could be a backup for them.
Yeah, because what I like about Ulis and a couple of other guys is that there is an intense value to getting 48 quality minutes from primary ball handlers, and I think Ulis will probably never be a starter, but if he can be a 15-minute-a-game guy, look at what we just saw with the Detroit Pistons and the Brooklyn Nets and all those teams that were completely hamstrung by not being able to do anything close to that. And so if you can get 15 minutes from a guy from the second round, especially with the positive leadership characteristics, I mean, the guys who played with him at Kentucky like him more than basically any other guy who's gone through Kentucky, and that matters. You know that they really like him. So that's one.
Yeah, Chicago point guard, by the way, too.
Oh, God.
That is highly important.
I'm really actually intrigued by the Clippers taking Diamond Stone. He is not a perfect player, but he is. I would love to see what he'll be in 2 to 3 years, just because I think he can be intriguing around the basket, and if he can, you know, really learn and work hard defensively, maybe he can become a little something. I actually probably like him better than Bryce Johnson.
The guy that I really thought was a good risk, number 43 to Houston. Not a surprise that they would go with Zoki, the Chinese center. There has been, again, much consternation about his age after the Yi on the On flap, where he was actually born 3 years earlier than he was was listed as in the 2007 draft. There's less evidence with So that he is actually the age, or that he is older than listed, but you know, the consensus kind of seems to be that he's anywhere between, you know, 0 and 2, 3 years older. But just, again, with these age things, his statistical translations were so dominating out of the Chinese league, and he's got such length. He is a great shot blocker. He's got a nice touch, not a versatile jumper. Like, I saw him at the Hoop Summit last year. He didn't really play very much because of an ankle injury, but his jump shot, he's got kind of a slow release. Like, can't, you know, he's going to be more like a slow spot-up guy if he's going to shoot it. But he is absolutely money when he can actually get that shot off. And he's also an excellent shot blocker and has some ability to put the ball on the floor and actually get to the rim. I mean, he's going to be one of these guys, and he's got a soft jump hook. But just when he's playing as well as he is at, theoretically, the age that he is, 43, you might as well take him. And obviously the Rockets have plenty of experience with Chinese players after having drafted Yao Ming. Zhou will not come over until next year. His buyout is going to be exactly what the amount is, the excluded international player payment, which is basically the amount that a team can contribute to an international buyout. So he'll play this year in China and then should be over next year. Kind of a shame because he needs to get so much stronger. I don't know how much stronger he can get, though, because he's just so thin, but he definitely needs to get into a U.S. strength program immediately.
Two other guys I'll mention, partially because they're both French, but partially because I like them. Isaiah Cordonnier, who we saw at the Hoop Summit, a little bit more bounce than I expected. I thought, you know, he's not all the way there yet as a player, but Atlanta took him at 44. And then, because I am a fan of any really long European nationality big man, Peter Cornelie, who went to Denver at 53, intriguing as an eventual piece, maybe not right away.
Yeah, skinny Frenchman, stretch 4, stretch 5, ton of length, but doesn't do a ton more in the times I've seen him other than just shoot threes and maybe block some shots. But, you know, that's not bad at 53, and Denver obviously has an excellent track record of drafting European guys in the second round. Paul Zipser, a guy who should probably be on the Bulls roster next year. He's going to be joining the Bulls, according to John Gavoni, and is kind of just a role player, combo forward type. We'll see whether he can actually crack their rotation or not. And that's really about all the ones that I really thought were particularly sexy picks in the second round.
Keith Felder will be fun if he makes the team, but I like him. But
it actually drafted higher than the player to whom he is most often compared, Isaiah Thomas, amazingly enough.
Well, it's hard to be drafted and not be drafted higher than Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah, that's right. And we did see a bunch of guys, too, who ended up signing immediately after the draft, probably got better deals than some of the guys at the end. Gary Payton, who I think at least is going to make a roster because he's so athletic and was a favorite of KP's statistical translations. Ron Baker, another guy as well, who, you know, is a shooter, played 4 years at Wichita State. So he, and then the only other guy who kind of has been talked about a little bit, at least in our circles, is Fred Van Vliet out of Wichita State, who is one of the highest translated guys for KP. He went undrafted. I haven't found out where he's headed yet, but I think that should just about do it for our draft. I mean, so who are your big winners and losers before we go?
Big winners, Philadelphia and Denver. The two teams that I've been pimping for such a long time, and they both absolutely killed it in this draft.
Yeah, I think, you know, getting Ben Simmons was obviously good. I think Korkmaz and Luau, guys who can eventually play a role, have some stash ability. Yeah, and Denver, Jamal Murray and Hernan Gomez. I thought that Murray should have been drafted higher than he was. Hernan Gomez probably should have been too. And both of those guys, I think Phil needs. Denver now really just has an embarrassment of riches, and we'll see what happens with them. You know, they do need some more long-term pieces on the wing still. They do have kind of these two combo forwards in Chandler, who's actually going to be around for a little bit longer. Gallinari can be a free agent after next year. Do they look to trade him? But, I mean, they've got Jokic, Moody, just so many young guys who are pretty good. Maybe nobody yet who looks like a future superstar, but I think they're going to be in pretty decent position, especially once Hernan Gomez and Murray start to look as good as I hope they will, where they could really get into sort of the blockbuster trade sweepstakes for a star, or just kind of let those guys grow and see what you have there.
Any other ones that you stood out to you as favorites?
You know, Boston, I felt like they could have done better at 16 and 23. I like Jaylen Brown for them. That would have been my pick. I'm probably alone in that. And definitely go back and listen to my podcast about him if you want to find out more about him. I said that already, but I don't have time to really kind of defend that here. And I think losers, I would say New Orleans. I don't think Hield is going to be that good. Minnesota, I think both those guys should have taken Murray instead. We'll see. That's more just my subjective opinion. I think Phoenix probably did pretty well too, I think.
Yeah, you know, I had my good drafts on my real GM right now.
Yeah, I mean, Chris and Bender are a really difficult fit together, but just in terms of the assets they're able to acquire, I thought that it was pretty good just getting some upside. Again, another team that, you know, one of those guys could become, Bender won't become a superstar, but he could be a star, and Chris maybe could be a superstar, but, you know, both those guys are really far away. But I think just in terms of getting young guys who have some upside, I liked it for them, and to get two picks in that top tier of guys to turn 13, 28 and Bogdanovich into that, I thought was well done. And then, you know, the Bucks, hit or miss. I like Maker okay. I think it could be decent for them. Who else do you not like? Do you agree with me on New Orleans and Minnesota?
I'm more okay with Minnesota just because I think I like Chris Dunn a little bit better. My three that I listed as having a bad draft are Charlotte is by far the worst because they made that horrible trade. That's really all they did. Atlanta, I thought that they just didn't capitalize on the resources that were proffered. And then Orlando, to me, because of how much I despise the trade.
Yeah, that wasn't too good. All right, that'll do it for today. You're going to be doing a write-up at Real GM, you said?
It's already up, yeah.
Ah, wow.
It is kind of my trademark now. It's actually the seventh year that I've done it. I try to rattle it off as soon as I can, and it's a lot of fun to do. I'm actually now, like, having talked about this, I kind of want to move a few teams around, but that's okay. And then also,
yeah, no, well, you can still do that before, like, as long as none of the guys have started playing in summer league yet. I think
I mean, basically, yeah. And the team that I'm thinking about moving is New Orleans, because I don't know, like, the way I slot teams, I just put them too high. I'll just move them to the kind of the bottom of their group. But did that, and then I'm actually going to record with Sam Vecenie immediately after this. So that will be, I think I'm going to go for a different tone on that one than this one. So there will be hopefully compliments.
Excellent, excellent. Well, follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Thank you again to everyone who is giving us an iTunes review or rating, or even if you're just telling your friends about us, or obviously patronizing our sponsors as well. And it's amazing to think after this crazy long blowout episode, we got the mock-off season coming up this weekend. I'm hoping to have the first edition of that out on Saturday. We're going to have the usual suspects. We're going to have some surprise suspects. It's going to just be amazing. Hopefully, it will live up to being what a lot of people say is the best episode we ever did last year. And this year is going to be even crazier. Two parts. I just can't wait for it. And so with that, I'm going to let Danny go, and we'll talk to you all next time. Till then. News from the world of bots. I'm a rather logical person, and as a result, on occasion, my friends will chide me by calling me NateBot, but I now have a bot friend that is the NBA's bot on Facebook Messenger. It's just a chat bot, a robot that you can talk to. You can basically message it through Messenger, and you can watch highlights of your favorite finals games or players. Message it to see the videos you want. All you have to do is go to nbabot.net. That's nbabot.net to get those awesome finals highlights or highlights of your favorite players during the playoffs.